What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the You Know Ball podcast. I am your host, Tro Bro Dude, and you'll never believe it, but I had an audio issue on this episode. I thought my mic was plugged in. It was apparently not plugged in, so my audio will be echoey and sound like I'm in a well for this episode, so we're back on this bullshit. But overall, great episode. I haven't talked to you guys in a while, so I just wanted to say what up at the top. And basically, thank Andrew Underberger from the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast and Billboard for coming on to talk about the Sixers. And like normal adult human beings, we talked about some good things with the Sixers. We talked about the last few games, and obviously we had the Hawks game, but there were some positives from that, and the Celtics game and the Wizards game, and that the Sixers are kind of getting a little bit back on track in general. Also learning not to like live and die with every game in a regular season that's been ravaged by COVID, and the team doesn't have a max player, and overall everything that goes with that. So I think that this was a normal conversation between two adult human beings who don't rely on a bunch of random professional athletes for our mental health. So I know things have been super rough with everything going on. I know a ton of people who have COVID right now. I hope that everyone's staying safe out there. As I said last week, I know that Christmas didn't really feel like Christmas this year. At least it didn't for me. Everything kind of sucks right now. So we tried to be positive in this episode. And in general, I haven't been super positive about the Sixers, and wanted to do some silver lining. So at the end of the episode, we talked about some silver lining, some things that we can look forward to, some positives that we can take from this season. So overall, just good vibes all around on this episode. It was a great conversation with AU. And once again, we'll not be having any more audio issues from here on out. That is, I hate this fucking cord. I don't know why it fell out of the thing while I was trying to record. But please just hang with me for that. Overall, just a quick update. Thank you everyone who donated to the Square recently. I haven't gotten a ton of donations, but I got one or two around Christmas, and it really made my day. Like I said, Christmas was kind of shitty for me this year, so I appreciate anyone who was able to support me through there, and all of you guys for listening this whole year. As a reward, we're going to do a best of episode that I will drop as a bonus episode later this week, probably like the day before New Year's Eve or something, where it's just all the best bits from this past season, past year, I should say, of the first year of the podcast. We're almost at 50,000 overall listens. We just passed 40,000 technically, but like we're close enough to 50,000 that like by the year anniversary of the podcast, we'll probably hit 50,000 listens, which is just absolutely amazing. And I can't thank you enough for your support. You can rate us on iTunes and Spotify if you want to support. Hopefully sometime in the next few weeks or months, I'm going to be planning out some new stuff that will be coming out. I'm hoping to maybe make some merch and do some different things into 2022 that will just be like 100% taking it to the next fucking level, dude. And as I said before, appreciate your support. I hope you had a better holiday than I did. And I hope that everything's going okay with you, and that you and your family and your friends and everyone can stay healthy, and that at least we can, you know, be together to bitch about the Sixers, but not on this episode. On this episode, positive, good vibes. Everything good all around, except for my audio. But just ignore that part. Please just live with it through this. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you guys soon. I'll be back later this week, and I might even do another episode and then also drop the bonus episode. So enjoy. I'll speak with you soon. What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the You Know Ball podcast. And today I'm very excited to have on a special guest. You probably know him from the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast. We got Andrew Unterberger. What's going on, AU?
Oh, not too much, man. It's another interesting week in Sixers land. It's like as I tweeted the other day, but it seems like they only have like really, really encouraging ruins and really, really just gut punch losses. Like There's no in between, at least it hasn't been for the last month or so.
Yeah, absolutely. And I keep seeing the Joel Embiid clutch time stats being thrown out there. And I'm like, yeah, because every fucking game is literally making me want to die, except for yesterday against the Wizards. But today we can just talk a little bit about kind of how we feel about where the Sixers are at right now, because I have, as I said to you,
been trying to learn how to not care about every single game.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the way to do it this year in particular. I mean, like, it's hard to not do it in the moment, and certainly I'm still living and dying in this sort of short-term sense with every game they play, but I'm a little bit better at kind of turning it off this year once the game ends, and, you know, you sort of move on, and you don't expect them to win every game, and you sort of, you know, it is sort of tough. Like going into the season, I didn't have great aspirations for what the team was going to be. I didn't think that the Simmons situation was going to get resolved quickly, and I didn't think the team without him was going to do particularly great things, especially because it seemed like they sort of played over their heads the year before. And so I sort of contented myself with like a 60% sort of win season, like a 46-36 kind of, maybe, you know, a few games better or worse than that. And it's one thing to sort of be ideologically okay with that. And it's another thing to actually watch the team lose 36 games, and do it. And sometimes in particularly excruciating fashion, and talk about all these games are close and all these games are kind of force the Sixers to show their true colors of one way or the other. But in general, yeah, I think that you do kind of have to take a step back, and you gotta kind of focus on the sort of the way we grew up doing it with these process seasons, where, you know, you kind of look for the sort of incremental wins and the sort of, you know, the small scale victories, and just you know, try not to think about the big picture too much.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it basically, like I said, has made me, a lot of these games have made me want to pull my hair out. But I agree with you in that it's really hard when you're on Twitter during the games to just be like, okay, this is fine. Because everyone on Twitter is like more reactionary than like people on Fox News. It's literally like every single possession is make or break. And it's like, it's an 82 game season. Like, there, and I think that we do it with specific players on the team. You know who I'm talking about, obviously. Tobias Harris.
Educated guess, yeah.
Yes, is the main catalyst of this, which is, even during, like, the Boston game, which I thought he was pretty good in the Boston game, definitely one of his better games this season, probably, until last night, probably the best game that he has had since he has returned from his bout with COVID. Mm-hmm. And I remember in the third quarter, he had, like, a bad turnover, and everyone was like, the entire timeline was basically like, get this guy the fuck out of here, you know, freaking out or whatever. But as you said, taking the incremental progress, taking things with, you know, we can't really take away too much from this, because obviously if the Sixers are to ever become a contending team again, I don't think that the roster is going to look anything like it looks like right now. And I also think that we know that you can't really take too much from this season just based on all the fucking weirdness that's happening in the NBA right now. Like, even if the Sixers were, and like you said before, you're like, oh, they'll be like 46-36, which, like, by the way, most of the NBA would take that. Like, I think Sacramento Kings would, like, literally kill to have a 46-36 season. But with the expectations that have been set with the Sixers, because we suffered through the process, or at least, you know, not necessarily suffered through the process, but because we lived through the process years and we have this generational talent in Joel Embiid, we really want to see the team succeed as much as possible. Over the past few games, I feel like I've been able to, like, not really care about the results as much. Mm. Like, the Boston game, I was glad that we won that game. But ultimately, if we had lost that game, I felt like the fact that we were down a few guys, you know, Joel looked good, Tobias looked good, Seth looked good, like, I could take positives from that game, even if they lost. We didn't have Maxey, we didn't have Drummond, we didn't have Shake. So what have you taken from the past few games, which included, obviously, the Celtics, the brutal loss of the Hawks, and then the win against the Wizards?
Well, I think that the Hawks was sort of, like, that loss was sort of, like, a good kind of test case for, like, you know, what we're talking about here, about not investing too much in the results. You know, I'm watching that game sort of thinking, okay, they have to win this game. They have to win this game. They didn't win the game. It's like, okay, so what are you going to do about that? Like, you know, they play another one in a couple of days and sort of life goes on. Like, they're not going to win the championship this year. They probably weren't going to win the championship this year if they had won the Hawks game. So you kind of had, like that game is sort of a good kind of gut check moment of like, okay, this isn't the team, this isn't the year. Yeah. So you really kind of have to divest yourself a little bit. Otherwise, you know, these losses are going to happen because the team's not good enough to avoid them. And you can't lose your mind with each one because there's, you know, another one coming up in a week or two. There might be another one coming up tomorrow night. We'll talk about that later, I'm sure. But in terms of like the positives with those games, I mean, I think the biggest thing for this season is just seeing Joel kind of maintain the level from last year. And obviously he got to a really slow start in terms of the shooting. And you look at his sort of month over month stats and, you know, the first month, I mean, remember, we forgot, like, he started the season kind of shooting, you know, 40-41%, averaging something like 21, 22 points a game. And those numbers are kind of,
Very bad for him.
Very bad for him. I mean, like, yeah, still all-star numbers for sure. And especially when you consider the defense and the fact that he's been, you know, a lot better with passing this year and recognizing double teams, and his assist to turnover ratio is, you know, light years better than it's ever been before.
Absolutely.
But this last few weeks, we're starting to see the shot kind of coming back. I mean, it still kind of comes and goes on a game-to-game basis. And the fact that I think he was like 0 for 9 from mid-range in that game against the Hawks is probably the biggest reason why they lost that game. But the shot has been there more often than not. And it was certainly there against the Wizards. And it was definitely there down the stretch against the Celtics, and the biggest reason they won that game. So, and you look at it on the season, his stats are starting to look basically like what they were last year. I mean, they're still a little bit higher to climb, but considering he was putting up pretty historic numbers for a big man last season, the fact that he's, you know, just one level below that now is still, you know, good enough. It's still good enough to consider him, you know, the All-NBA fringe MVP type player. And that's obviously the biggest thing with this team, and the biggest reason why you say you can't really afford to waste a season like this, even though our hands sort of being forced there. Beyond that, I mean, it's strikes and gutters with most of the guys on the team. I mean, I still love Seth. I love the fact that he's having this historic season from long two at a time when that shot's basically become, you know, you basically get ostracized for shooting a lot of those shots. But
by RGM.
By RGM, the guy who invented that shot being the worst shot in the league, basically. And now he's got the poster boy for it.
Do you happen to know the numbers on that? I've heard about this, about him having this like historic long two, which makes sense because it feels like every time he shoots a three with his foot on the line, he makes it.
Exactly. Now, I saw stats from mid-range. I don't really know how to define that. I think it's probably something like from you know, like 10 to 23 feet.
Right.
And as of, I think, 2 games ago, he was shooting 62.5% from that range, something like that. Some ungodly number, by far the highest in the league. And Joel was actually one of the lowest of you know, players who had taken a certain amount.
He's currently shooting 58% from mid-range, so it's gone down a little bit. But yeah, still, I mean, that's better than Kevin Durant and Chris Paul, who are the best mid-range shooters.
Exactly. And meanwhile, he's shooting like the lowest percentage from three, or at least he was at that point, the lowest percentage from three of his entire career. And his volume just keeps dropping there. It's the most inside-out season I've ever seen a great shooter have.
Right.
And it's fun, even as it's frustrating. I'm like you. I'm screaming at the TV, I could take the open three. Don't, if someone's got to shoot it, don't just keep trying to find a better shot when there's no, you know, the ball ends up in the corner with Matisse and he's got a guy with, you know, within a foot of him. And okay, now what do we do now?
Yeah.
But beyond that, I mean, I still think he's playing probably the best ball of his career. And Matisse is a joy to watch on defense. He's a joy to watch. And, you know, say what you will for Matisse on offense, and obviously he's been ghastly for a lot of these games. He like has somehow turned into the most willing shooter on the team. It's like him and Isaiah Joe, neither of whom are shooting above 30%. Like, those are the only two guys who are still just hoisting them.
Yeah.
And that's all I really want. I mean, I love to see more of them go in, obviously, but that's all I really want to see from Matisse, is just that when he has it in those spots, he's got to shoot it, because otherwise he's totally useless. And in addition to just missing the shots, he also just grinds the offense to a halt.
Yeah,
but obviously the defense is still otherworldly most nights. The you know, obviously the performance against Steph a couple of weeks ago was about the most joy that I've gotten from a single Sixers single game performance, not Embiid related.
Yeah, and Tatum, he had a great game against Tatum.
Sure, and even last night against last night or 2 nights ago, I don't remember at this point, against Spencer Dinwiddie, I thought he was really good too.
Yeah, who usually is prime MJ against the Sixers.
So. Yeah, very much a sort of always kills us kind of player. Joel is the only one that where it still feels like almost every, I mean, even the game against the Hawks where he misses the big shot at the end, and, you know, he has a rough night shooting the ball. He's still, I was like, still got 23-10 and good defense, and basically still the main reason we were in the game. So he's the only one that's kind of giving me that joy on a nightly basis. But Seth Matisse, I still loved. Tyrese is sort of, he seems to be kind of figuring out his role within the offense when Embiid's on the floor, which was obviously pretty rough those first couple games back.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I still like most of the guys on this team. I get a ton of joy out of Andre Drummond's just kind of free associative weirdness. his passing is just like, it's abstract art basically to me. And those are the moments that you really get to kind of separate the experience of watching the game from the results. Because these passes are just, I mean, like, you know, for every two good ones he threads, you know, a cutter, you know, Tobias running towards the basket or something, he'll do one to a guy who isn't even there, or he'll shoot it, he'll throw one of these fastballs that Carlos Ruiz couldn't have caught. And you kind of have to appreciate it on its own merits, just sort of outside the actual, you know, cost benefit analysis of the play itself, which is usually very, very low.
Yeah.
And it's fun to write about. And a lot of these, I don't really have a guy on this team this season that I'm just dreading them putting them in the game. Everyone either I think is playing well, or I always expect to snap out of their funk. Like Isaiah Joe, I always expect the shots to go in even when they don't.
Dude, I don't think I've ever seen someone rim out so many threes in a season at this point for Isaiah Joe.
Like I feel like counterintuitively, I feel like the solution with Isaiah Joe is just to start him, like just to play him like 30 minutes a night.
And immersion therapy.
Just wait for the shots to start going in. I feel like they have to at some point. Like, and the fact that he's willing to take, like, again, him and Matisse are the two guys that seem like that, like, it's like slumping doesn't affect their willingness to get the shots off at all. Like,
which is what we need, really.
Yeah, like I almost would prefer Isaiah Joe going 2 for 10 than, you know, Seth going 3 for 3. Like it gets to a point where you just want to see the shots go up.
And it's Hooper mindset. Yeah, I mean, it's Hooper mindset, which is something we always talk about on here. If you are a willing and able three-point shooter and you're a threat, I mean, we even saw it at the end of the Celtics game. Isaiah Joe ended the Celtics game with 1 point, and 1 point on 0 of 2 shooting, and 2 rebounds, no assists. He closed that game, and because of the fact that he is a willing and able three-point shooter, like, it was basically like when Matisse went out, the half-court offense changed, and Beat, of course, took over down the stretch, so the results look a lot better. But when you have those guys, like, the reason why Danny Green works so much better with the starters is because he is just willing to absolutely chuck from three. He relocates, he knows where to be, and with this past few games especially, but as I said to you before the podcast, like, it's really the last like 4 years the Sixers have had this issue of just unwilling shooters. And I think when you're trying to figure out, when your 3 or 4 best players are Seth Curry, who is a historically good three-point shooter, but as you said, the volume keeps going down. I think that Seth has gotten more valuable for the Sixers due to his, like, pick and roll creation and his shot creation in general.
Which has gotten a lot better this season.
Absolutely. I mean, he's playing at like a very, like you said, probably the best ball of his entire career. And it's interesting that a guy comes to the Sixers as this insane three-point shooter, and we need him to do much more than that. And he's actually filled the role very well. But as you said, it's taken a step back from a volume perspective, and the Sixers would ideally like to have Seth Curry shooting as many threes as he did in the playoffs last year, where you're getting him shooting 7 threes in a game. You're getting him to be this absolute assassin off of the catch. He, you know, his pull-up threes are down in volume and in percentage this year. They haven't been falling nearly as much, but when he's exchanging those for long twos, it is creating a little bit more inefficient offense. But I think him being, like, as Doc said, like, he wants to try to use him as point guard, which I don't necessarily agree with, but it is the situation that the Sixers are in right now. And then you surround him from a spacing perspective with Embiid, who, you know, can shoot threes, but once again, low-volume guy, works best out of the post. Tobias, low volume guy, works best out of the post. And then Maxey, who is just, you know, more used to shooting threes as a pull-up guy, and he's actually more effective at that, then it creates a little bit of an issue. And you're going to have games like the Hawks game, and you're going to have games like the Wizards first half, where the Sixers just don't attempt threes. And it really makes it like, when the defense isn't as elite as it has been in the past, like it was last year for the Sixers, and they're not getting out and running in transition as often, you really need those threes to kind of make up for the fact that, you know, the defense isn't great and we're not just getting easy points in transition with Ben and Tobias and all that stuff that we were doing last year. So right now it feels like even Furkan, like, until last night, like, in the Hawks game, he was not putting up threes at the same rate that he used to. He's taking long twos. Like, I don't, why is this team so dependent on the mid-range and long twos to kind of, you know, generate, it feels like 50% of their half-court offense at least.
Can I offer you my very Bill Simmons theory about Seth's unwillingness to take threes?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I'll give like a more actual explanation. But I do wonder, like I was looking at, you know that he came to the Sixers with the sort of title of being of having the highest active career 3-point shooting percentage. He had one game like four games ago. I can't remember who was against at this point, where he actually dipped below Joe Harris for in that ranking. He went down to number two among active career shooters. And I kind of wonder if that's getting in his head a little bit. Like maybe that's why he's taking, you know, he went, then the next game he went 3-for-3, and then the next game after that he went 2-for-2. I was like, well, maybe he's just trying to get that number back up and kind of give himself more of a more breathing room. I don't know. It's almost certainly not that.
It will be his legacy.
Yeah. Well, look, I would kind of be like that too if I was a shooter in the league. I'd be like, man, I got to keep that number up. And like, I sort of appreciate the players that put undue pressure on themselves to kind of keep these arbitrary like streaks and stat records going. That's probably not actually the case. I do think we have seen, when Seth does take more threes this season, at least, I think he was better in the postseason last year. But when he does take more threes, when he kind of, you know, gives himself a shorter window to get them off, and he does it maybe while he's kind of moving or when he has a guy closing on him, it does seem like his accuracy drops pretty significantly. And he's not good at taking those Steph like 30-foot threes where, you know, they just kind of leave him 5 feet behind the arc and he just kind of hoists out of nowhere. Like that's not his shot. He's a great shooter, and probably the reason why his percentage has been so high for his career is because he is that selective with the 3 points of shots he takes. And maybe if he wasn't, if he shot twice as many, maybe his 3-point percentage would go down, not a little, but a lot. I think we're seeing that, you know, with the combination of slow release, he's undersized, he doesn't necessarily have unlimited range. That there is something to the fact that, you know, he's that selective for a pretty good reason. I think there's still got to be a balance. You still can't have the best shooter on your team taking two or three threes a game, especially when your team is built around 3-point shooting outside of your big guy. Like, it's an explanation, but it's not really an excuse.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree with that. I think that that's something that I'm sure it is in his mind a little bit. And I do think it is a little bit Bill Simmons-y, but you know, Bill's got some gems, and so, you know, sometimes it is as simple as guys being aware of those things. I think it definitely is part of Tobias's thing. Like, I don't think that Tobias has been like a 40% 3-point guy, like what, 3 of the last 4 years. He is not this year, but like, I definitely think he's more comfortable in the mid-range. And I think that it factors in when you talk about just like, I'm always going to look for the best shot for me or for my teammates or whatever it is. And I'm trying to be the most comfortable. Now, part of the reason why Seth was shooting so many threes last year in the playoffs was, one, we needed him to, and two, he was playing more minutes. So on a 100 possession basis, like the per 100 numbers, I'm sure they were similar, but because we had him playing in the upper 30s in terms of minutes last year, I'm sure that that helped add some to his attempt total. But one of the things is, like, I think that the Ben like created threes thing was definitely overblown, because it's like, you know, we've talked about this. It's like, you know, Ben doesn't shoot threes. He's always looking to create open threes for his teammates. And that definitely played a little bit into, you know, those numbers. But there definitely has been a lack of just like positive passing. And early in the season, we were seeing a lot of the ball movement stuff, which we've seen at moments, but there has been a lot of like guys trying to do too much by themselves recently. It's felt a lot like, and I think that that's one of the pitfalls of like, I feel like Embiid doesn't even really trust his teammates right now. I feel
It's tough for him to trust his teammates when they clearly don't even trust themselves.
Of course, 100%. I'm not even criticizing Embiid for that. I'm saying that it's like when they're not playing exactly the role that we need them to play around Joel Embiid, he's like, fuck it, I'll take over. And you're going to have games like the Celtics game where he absolutely dominates. And then you're going to have games like the Hawks game where he's cold from the field, and it's going to, you know, make or break what we can do in the half court. So I think overall the offense has been fine recently. Like, they were historically cold in that Hawks game. I think they made like 4 threes all night, maybe 5 threes all night. And the Celtics game, I would have liked to see them put up more threes, but they made like 40% of them. And ultimately what I feel like is the same thing that I keep talking about on every fucking podcast, and I'm sure I sound like a broken record, is like, I think you can figure out the defense around Embiid. Like, I'm not really worried about that. I don't want it to become a Rudy Gobert situation in the playoffs last year where the perimeter defense is so bad that it's pretty much he's just constantly trying to recover and leaving guys open from three and all that shit when teams are trying to go, you know, spread you out a little bit more. But I do think that you can figure out a way that, like, I feel like Maxey's made a lot of progress on the defensive side throughout the year. He's had a few really good performances. I think his off-ball defense has been a lot better recently than it was earlier in the season. And I think that ultimately building a decent defense around Joel Embiid is not hard. And when we ultimately can solve that issue, because that has been a big thing, is on the offensive end, just having guys who are absolutely, like, I watched the Warriors on Christmas against the Suns, and Otto Porter put up like 5 threes in a row, and I was like, you're allowed to do that?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable watching other teams and the things that they're allowed to do.
It feels like they're playing a different sport when I watch other teams. Like Kelly Oubre, who, by the way, you talked about this earlier. It's like, yeah, maybe if Seth shot twice as many threes, his percentage would dip by 5% or whatever, even though the outcome of that would probably be better for the team. I don't want Kelly Oubre, but I want Kelly Oubre-brained guys who were just like, I'm literally never going to stop shooting, even if I'm fucking, like you said, Isaiah Joe, 2 for 10, whatever it is. I want that Hooper brain mentality where guys are just absolutely just totally willing to let it fucking fly from three. Because I think ultimately, if you're going to build around a post-up center in the modern NBA, you have to be willing to do that. And honestly, I think Tyler Johnson has had moments this year. Like the one game he shot 3 threes in like 4 possessions. And I was like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah, no, he seems like good news. And I have definitely the last few games have given me a greater appreciation for Danny Green and just the willingness. Like,
oh, absolutely.
He's a tough player to watch night to night, just because, you know, the 2 for 8 games are as frequent as the 4 for 8s and you know, and in those 8 will be a couple where you're just kind of like, what? Like, what? That wasn't the moment. That wasn't
3
the shot.
Straight,
like,
air balls when he against the Nets earlier this
year. Or when he takes those pull-ups in transition, or he kind of dribbles one step in just to jump back and then take one. Like,
he's shooting like 14% on pull-ups this year.
Yeah, which, and even that feels high anecdotally, but it's like that with him. But again, he'll shoot them, and you really don't know how much you miss that until you get these possessions where the ball just kind of, you know, whips one way around the perimeter, then whips back, and eventually someone has to drive and take a contested 12-footer. Definitely we do need some of that kind of gung-ho spirit, and it's kind of breaking my heart to watch Furkan kind of like he feels like he's just been broken by this latest slump. Like, Furkan's gone through slumps before, but I guess it's a combination of both how long the slump has lasted and the fact that the Sixers haven't really been able to kind of just yank him from the rotation for 2 weeks and kind of let him get his head right on the bench, which they've been able to do in past years, because we've either had a deeper teams or just, you know, not as racked with injuries and sickness as we have been this year.
Yeah, absolutely. But
this year we kind of needed him to play through it, and he just couldn't.
I have a quick question about that for you.
Yeah.
Do you think that it correlates? Because like his early season play, when he was looking like, as I called him, the homeless version of Luka Doncic on the podcast, which is like that, not even a negative thing. It's a compliment. Yeah, I mean, to be even compared to Luka in general. But the thing about him is, like, I felt like the second that Shake came back, he lost a lot of that confidence. Because he was moved from being on ball a lot, having to run those second units. I felt like his confidence kind of went, like, I think Joel said that he thought he was rushing his shot a lot, and he was turning down threes more recently, which is like something we've never seen from him before. And it feels like Furkan actually he's going to have his bad nights, but like there have been games where like he's not putting up stats, but like he's driving. He's probably the best passer on the team right now, which is not a great sign.
No, it's not what you want, certainly.
Yeah, usually when you construct your roster, you don't want like your 8th or 9th man to be the best passer on the team, just generally speaking. But it does feel like since Shake came back, and Shake's actually played pretty well this year, is that like Furkan's confidence has kind of gone away. And like, I feel like this is another Bill Simmons-y thing. where it's like, you know, remember when the Celtics used to like run like two post ups or three post ups to start the game for Kendrick Perkins like he had like confidence in himself, basically, and didn't have like, I don't know, imposter syndrome about his role on the team or whatever. But like, I feel like if you just give Furkan the ball, like when he first comes in, and just let him like eat a few possessions, like running pick and roll or just like creating for himself or whatever, that might help boost his overall spirits and he'll be a more effective player. I don't know. Once again, it's a Bill Simmons take, but that's kind of how I feel. I feel like since Shake came back and Maxi and Shake have had more ball handling opportunities with Furkan on the court, that he hasn't been quite as good.
No, I mean, I did have a theory, I think last year, that like Shake and Furkan can never be hot at the same time. and I wouldn't even say that like Shake's strong play this year is not like due to any sort of streakiness, either shooting or scoring.
No.
It's just been kind of all around solid in a way that he was not last year when he was much more up and down.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the Furkan, like I don't know if it's directly attributable to Shake. That certainly might play a part in it. But it does seem like the team kind of goes as he goes in a spiritual sense again, which is not what you want for your eighth man, your backup, like. Backup small forward should not be kind of the bellwether for the entire team's confidence, but it does seem like that. It seems like
that's
a great point. Yeah, when the two of them, because not only are they the two streakiest shooters maybe on the team, they're also like the two most like chest puffed guys on the team. Like they're the guys that'll kind of like start jawing at people in the stands and like, you know, make weird hype videos online and just like. It just sort of seems like they kind of lift the entire team when they're making shots, and when they're not, it just seems to be. It's a drag on the offense certainly, but it also seems to be a kind of drag on the team spiritually. Like when those two guys don't have their kind of cockiness in place, then the entire team starts passing up shots, and the entire team starts kind of sulking when the other team goes on an 8-0 run. And it does seem like those two guys have a very outsized impact on the sort of the way the entire team goes in moments like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't even disagree with that. I feel like and that's kind of the thing where, like, last night in the Wizards game, you saw it. It felt like no one was willing to even attempt a three until those two guys came in and started putting up threes. And
it changed the game, yeah.
Yeah, and also Furkan was willing to actually shoot out of the slump, which was something that he's not been willing to do recently. And I feel like this kind of is proving the theory, which is like, put high volume 3-point shooters around Joel, put guys who can get pressure on the rim and get to the line, and also just have positive passers and decision makers around him, and you will have good offense. And even when Joel's off the court, like we've seen some positive things because of the fact that it's just like this more like playing together as a team. And it is more just like kind of like using the entire half court offense as like a playmaking engine. You're not having as much ball stopping, especially when Tobias and Joel are off the floor. Joel brings ball stopping in a way that is positive, and Tobias not necessarily always. Mm. You know, last night was like the perfect example of like why Tobias still has value to an NBA team, but it just doesn't make any sense on the Sixers. Like, in that Wizards game, because you're like, oh, what is he doing? And it's like, oh, he's literally like posting up smaller players. He's able to get to the line more. He's able to actually score pretty efficiently. And he's, you know, getting rebounds because he's one of the bigger guys that's out there, like that stuff. But you're like, when your best player is Joel Embiid, you probably don't need Tobias Harris.
Yeah, and this is why I feel like I've actually been more like, despite being an historically anti-Tobias guy, at least
you're the Tobias guy, I feel like.
I was in terms of how they got him and what they did to keep him here, I was very much anti that. But I've actually been one of his biggest defenders this season, just because I do feel sort of what you're saying is true, in that the guy that we're watching right now, I mean, he still seems compromised. I don't know if it's COVID or small injuries or what, but.
Like, I feel like he looks slower.
It's a combination of slower and just kind of less imposing. Like I last season, he was a terror in transition. He had like these Giannis like moments in transition where he would just kind of go barreling down the lane, and even though there were two guys in front of him, they would just kind of bounce off of him, and he would be able to score at the rim. You haven't seen that at all this season. I can't remember a single possession. Like, I mean, I'm sure there've been a couple, but
in the Celtics game was probably there were like one or two possessions where I was like, that was what we saw from Tobias in transition last year. Because it's funny you bring that up, because I think I saw you post about this on Twitter, and I remember looking up, like, Tobias was literally one of the most efficient scorers in the NBA last year for like four or five different categories, like transition scoring, pick and roll scoring, shooting off the catch, and post-ups. And I was like, if we could even, and I know that Tobias last year, there were no fans. And also Ben Simmons was here, which made his job easier on defense and created open looks for guys. And they have a little bit of a chemistry between them as well. But like, it just does feel, if it was like, even if we could get last year's version of Tobias back in some capacity, that this team would be significantly better.
Yeah, and I think we will see more of that. I mean, he has had these stretches over the, you know, the past, you know, whatever, two plus, almost three seasons at this point, where he does kind of spend a month, you know, and when he isn't doing the things he needs to be doing to contribute, he just looks like a total nothing out there, because right. He doesn't, there is no like Joel sort of fallback of, oh, well, you know, at least he's still, you know, terror on defense, or Ben like pushing the ball in transition. When he's not going, all he does is slow down the offense, and sometimes
even like Danny Green, you're like, well, at least he provides spacing. Like,
yes,
Tobias not being a willing 3-point shooter and also kind of needing the ball to be successful makes it so that when he isn't shooting and scoring well, that he is like a negative.
So he needs to do those things consistently. And last year he did them consistently almost for the entire season,
right.
and that's why, you know, the worm kind of turned for him. This year it hasn't been as consistent, but there are excuses if you want them and if you want to reach for them. But I do think that that'll turn around. He has done a little bit more of it recently. I'm a little worried about the game against the Wizards, because he had his best game, I think, shooting zero threes, maybe. Like maybe took one. I don't remember.
Oh, no. Fuck.
it was definitely like that, where, and you know, you worry about the Sixers kind of taking the positive reinforcement of, he had a much better game just kind of playing in the mid range and trying to bullying small defenders.
You can hear Doc
like
already talking about it. You know, we don't want Tobias to try to shoot too many threes. We want Tobias to be comfortable. And then it's like, Doc, come on, dude.
Yeah. And comfort is definitely the blessing and the curse for this team. So that definitely worries me a little bit, but I still think he's not a total negative. I don't want to trade him for Kevin Love. Like I think that there will be a version of this team where he's still a positive contributor, and without him, that there's really not. I mean, if you want to rely on Maxey in games that really matter, then sure. But we will need sort of a, you know, and you saw this last night, which was the best thing to take from that performance, is that Joel took like a good 3 or 4 minutes off in the second quarter. Like, he was in the game, but he was just passing the ball to, you know, they were feeding Tobias in the post. Joel was just kind of hanging out by the 2-point line on the wing, letting Tobias go. And like, for Joel to be as good as he was in the second half, he will need those stretches, you know, 4 or 5 minutes a game where he can just kind of hang back and be a secondary option. You know, when the ball kicks out to him, hopefully he actually takes a three. That's always a risk with Joe too. But you know, he needs those kind of stretches where he can take it easy and let somebody else be the focal point on offense.
Absolutely.
And even when we do have, you know, Seth or Tyrese, who've both been obviously much improved on offense this year, those guys still need Joel. They need him to set picks. They need him to be a role threat. They need him to pop. Like, Joel doesn't get to just hang back and let those guys do their thing. They're not those players yet. And in Seth's case, he never will be. But with Tobias, Joel can legitimately take that possession mostly off for a couple minutes at a time. And so I think when you're looking for the thing that Tobias gives the Sixers that nobody else does, that's the thing. Now, if he's, you know, taking 10 seconds out of the shot clock and shooting a contested fadeaway that goes in at like a 30% rate, that's still not good enough. But if he's as good as he was last night, then that will help in both the short term and a long term sense. And it'll allow B to take over the games when it really matters. So the games like that are both discouraging and encouraging from Tobias. And you just hope that he's efficient enough when doing it that the discouraging parts don't outweigh the positives.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think that last night they were using him a little bit differently than they have been. Like, he was screening for Seth, and he was able to, like, attack the scrambling defense a little bit more. I think that when you start a possession with Tobias at the top of the key and you go, all right, figure it out, usually not going to be a great result from that. I don't think that he's a good enough shooter, scorer, passer, decision maker to really create or like maybe it is an injury or whatever is slowing him down this year. Maybe he's just getting older. I don't know what it is. But he doesn't really create enough advantages with his handle or his size or his speed when he's out at the perimeter, which is why the fit with Embiid can be a little bit clunky. But when they're just starting a possession, making sure that he's getting that post positioning and they're dumping it down there to him, or he's able to attack a scrambling defense as a screener, or he's popping out or whatever it is, I feel like he can be more effective as a play finisher, and that's kind of what we need him to be. And the hope is that if he is on this team, that he will slide down the totem pole once again when it comes to creation responsibilities, and that he can be effective. We have yet to see whether he can be effective as a scalable type scorer for extended periods of times, but he definitely has moments and games where you're like, okay, I can see the value that he can bring to a team, and hopefully it is with the Sixers sometime soon. So actually being in a positive mood for the first time, maybe ever on this podcast, I feel like we can talk just a little bit about the silver linings of this season, which is why I wanted to have you on, because it has been a weird year, obviously, with everything going on in the NBA right now, with the Sixers, with the Ben Simmons thing hanging over. I didn't want to talk about the Ben thing the entire podcast once again, because I've spent way too much fucking time doing that. And let's
can I ask you one thing, Ben,
yeah,
related
absolutely.
To move on?
Yeah. I have one thing Ben related on here too. So
okay.
Don't worry about it.
What do you think about, like, a sort of Ben Simmons for All-Star campaign, like about Sixers Twitter really getting behind it.
It's a great bit. It's a great bit. I appreciate the commitment to the bit, and I also love that, like, Ben Simmons becoming an All-Star in a season where he doesn't play. It's going to be to the point where it's like the Joe Johnson thing, where it's like,
oh yeah, yeah,
7-time All-Star Joe Johnson. And you're like, how many fucking All-Star teams did he make? And speaking of Joe Johnson, I just want to say, I love to see that he was back in the league at 40 years old hooping the other night, and everyone was excited on Twitter. But I also hate the fact that he's only in the league because we're 2 years into a fucking plague right now, and it's still not going away.
It's a fun subplot that's really not that fun when you think about it. But
it's like when they do those stories on the news and they're like, this woman walked to work because she couldn't afford the bus. And I'm like, that's not inspiring at all. That's fucking horrible. Why are we talking about this? But going back to the Ben thing, I do love the All-Star campaign thing. I think it's funny. The one thing I realize, and I don't know how I've not realized this and all the time following the Sixers and just doing this podcast, but like when Clutch tweeted the Ben Simmons for All-Star thing, because they did it with like all their clients, I guess. I just thought it was really funny. How have I not realized that Ben Simmons is signed to Clutch Sports?
Oh, I did not really consider the implications there, but yeah, that
like, arguably the least clutch player in the NBA.
Yeah, there's definitely some grand scale irony going
yes,
on there.
Absolutely. Just incredible dedication to the bit all around here from everyone. But no, I mean, I thought it was funny. I think, hey, if it helps his trade value, I'm all for it.
Yeah, I haven't really worked out the logistics of how or if it helps us, but I know that the things that both Sixers Twitter and All-Star Weekend thrive on is chaos.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's sort of the element for both institutions. And I think that Ben Simmons being at the All-Star game, hopefully as a voted in starter, would definitely be the sort of peak in that in both respects.
I mean, hey, if fucking Derrick Rose and all these guys can get votes, I mean, Derrick Rose.
Iverson, I think, got voted in 1 year when he wasn't playing.
Yeah, of course. I mean, fuck it. I mean, for the past 10 years, Derrick Rose has been like top five. Alex Caruso was last year for the like, fuck it. Why not? Just let it happen.
Especially because Ben Simmons historically has always been like a very low vote getter. Like the years they actually deserved to make the All-Star team, yeah, he would finish like 10th behind, like, you know, Kemba Walker, injured and you know playing one way and only averaging 18 a game or whatever, and he would still be 500,000 votes below him and Derrick Rose, like you're saying. Like, so yeah, like let's have the year where he literally hasn't played a second. Let's
keep the makeup.
Yeah, it's time, I think.
Well, it's also like people said, like, yeah, Ben might not have deserved to be an All-Star last year, but he did deserve to be an All-Star his rookie year. So that kind of made up for it. You know what I mean? So, yeah. All right. So silver linings from this season. I'm going to say my first one, which is, this is just another Mickey Mouse season. Like, this is, I said on Twitter, it's like, The bubble was Mickey Mouse. Last year was Disney Plus, and this year is an extremely goofy season.
Okay.
And with all of the COVID shit happening, like, I ultimately think when people look back at this time, if not to get all Zach Lowe on us, but if they ever have a time to look back on, that, like, people are going to look at this season with a real side eye. Because not only is there, like, the COVID protocols are going to continue to happen for the rest of the season into the playoffs. We saw Chris Paul go into COVID protocols during a very important time last year. People missed, like, the play-in game last year. I don't think that people are going to look at that. Like, even if the Sixers won the title, like, figured it out, won the title, it would take, like, Giannis or KD or one of these guys to either be injured or in COVID protocols. And while I would take it and I would act like none of this stuff ever happened, I don't think that we're going to look back at as fondly on this season as we will on a lot of seasons. And I think that if there is one silver lining to take from this is that if the Sixers, when they don't win the title, that most people aren't really going to care about the champion this year unless, you know, COVID is solved in the next, you know, 6 months.
Well, I like that, although I do have to sort of bring up the counter argument there, which is that we're now in year three of this. How confident are we that this just isn't the NBA forever? Like,
we're the world forever.
Well, in which case, I guess that'll make you know, this thing a lot, you know, less sharp if you know, this thing doesn't really work out with the Sixers long term. Is that, I guess, just put an asterisk not next to like any particular NBA season, but maybe just the NBA in general, just like an entire sport with an asterisk next to it
every year forever. But yeah, no. Yeah, on top basically. Of that, like, I think that I won't really worry about my take being freezing cold if this is what the world's like. So
that's true. Yeah, maybe bigger fish to fry in that case. The biggest one for me, I think, you know, beyond Embiid still being Embiid, is probably that while the Sixers have obviously, you know, I guess you'd say they've underperformed, although I don't think they've underperformed that dramatically, but, you know, clearly being one game over 500 is not, you know, an ideal situation, but it's not a total disaster. And you would sort of hope that the team, you know, and I wrote about this a little bit, but the teams that we are most likely to be dealing with in the future, a lot of them have had more disastrous seasons than we've had. You know, we look at the Blazers, you look at the Kings, and other teams of that ilk, where eventually we're gonna have to take advantage of the misery of one of these teams in order to extract, you know, maximum return for Ben Simmons. And the Sixers are definitely not in the place. I feel like these other teams are in more of a place of urgency, even if they're not necessarily acting like it at the moment. But they're in more of a place of urgency to actually do something now to turn things around. And the Sixers, who are still in the playoff picture, still generally, I would say, considered to be a, you know, a good team. And, you know, the things that they're struggling with are not things that we were desperate that Ben Simmons would be, you know, the first line of defense against. So it's not like we're hurting for his services in a disproportional rate. So I would say that I'm thankful that our leverage in the situation, I don't know if it's said it's gone up, but it hasn't gone down dramatically. And there's especially if they can kind of keep on sort of a positive upswing while, you know, the other teams are going through harder times than they are in terms of the COVID protocol stuff, then we'll be in a pretty good place when it actually does come time to make this Ben Simmons trade, if it happens this year.
This is a QAnon podcast, so we'll have a new date to look forward to after we don't trade him at the trade deadline.
That's true,
what's the date of the draft next year? I'll have my new QAnon date that I can talk about.
But yeah, keep shifting the goalposts on that one for sure.
I do agree with you. I think that there's two sides to this, though. I think other teams are more desperate right now, for sure. I think that teams might not necessarily be willing to, like, go all in right now because of everything that we've discussed. But I think that teams are going to get antsy. GMs are going to be under fire. I think the teams are going to be more desperate to win in the now. And Ben does help with that. Like, I think that we know that he's a good, positive impact regular season player, even with all of his flaws. And I actually had as one of my things, which is that, you know, obviously the Sixers, like you said this, like, I don't really think they're underperforming all that much. I think they're like 14-8 with Joel Embiid, which is like a 52 win pace, which like most fans would be pretty happy with a 52 win season. And the reality is that Joel Embiid will never play every game, and that is not the world that we live in. But also, the reality is that whatever happens without Joel Embiid literally doesn't matter at all, because if Joel Embiid's hurt, we're fucked. So I just want to bring this back to the fact that it's like Ben has proven to be a contributor to regular season winning. Like, the defense, the transition playmaking, everything that everyone always talks about definitely has some sort of positive impact on the Sixers in the regular season. And it's part of the reason why they were the one seed and they had this great record last year. And I I think that if the Sixers were to be still in first place and they would be, you know, number, what, they had a top three offense and the team as a whole looked great when the shots were falling and the playmaking as a team was great and all this shit, that teams would be looking at the Sixers being like, why the fuck do we want to trade for Ben
Simmons? No, it's a fair point. It was definitely something I was considering during that 8-2 start. It's like, is this definitely a good thing? Like, maybe it is. I don't know. I feel like you could spin that either way if you really wanted to, but definitely there would be, you know, the teams looking at that being like, okay, well, you know, the entire, you know, bill of sale with this guy is that, you know, he's not a plus contributor in the playoffs for a bunch of obvious reasons, but yeah, he racks up, you know, he's never missed the playoffs in the regular season. He racks up wins. He helps in the sort of on-court product immeasurably on both sides of the ball when he's healthy and when they're playing not elite competition and in a not particularly high stress environment. But yeah, so I think that's a fair point that you want the team to be good enough to not be desperate, but not so good that other teams don't look at us going like, well, maybe we'd be better off without this guy too. Clearly doesn't really affect that much. Yeah.
Yeah. I, that's just kind of how I feel about the whole situation. It's like, I feel like I don't think that it's moved the needle too far in one direction or the other, but it could have been a lot worse. It could have been, as you said, when we're starting off hot, it's like, yeah, this might be good for, like, obviously we want to win, but like, we've known we're a good regular season team before. Like, mm-hmm. It is a hard thing to balance because it's like I talked about earlier, like learning not to take every game like I'm going to die if they lose the game. But at the same time, also being like the regular season really doesn't matter all that much. Like, yeah, in the grand scheme of things,
it's a safe point at this point.
Exactly. And it's like, if the Sixers won 65 games this year, would you feel really good about them going into the playoffs? Because I still don't think I would. I still would be like, I got to see it first. And last year might have been kind of just this confirmation bias that, you know, we've had about all the players on the team other than Joel. But, like, now it's got to the point where it's like, we know that we're not winning a championship with this core and that if we were this dominant regular season team, that teams might be looking at us with a side eye about what we're asking for in Ben Simmons trade situations, and they already are. So it could make things potentially worse. But there is another silver lining, and that's the obvious one, which we've touched on and I've talked about on the podcast. Tyrese Maxey is a future star. Like, I think that at this point, I think part of me, it was like, I don't want to overreact too much to what I see from Tyrese in the first half of the season going into the year, but like, I feel like he could take a leap and like going from like being like showing flashes, but overall probably being a negative as a rookie, like you would expect from most rookie point guards, that I felt like I didn't want to overreact too much. But one of the things that I did last year was like the psychopath that I am, I compared him to some guards that were in similar molds to him from their rookie seasons to his rookie season. And it was like Jamal Murray, De'Aaron Fox, guys that are kind of in the general same mold as Maxey. And today I went and I compared Maxey's second season to Jamal Murray's, and they're almost fucking identical. Like, it's really to the point where it's like, yes, of course, Murray's a better three-point shooter, and Maxey isn't quite the willing three-point shooter that he is. And I think that Maxey is a better finisher around the rim, and he'll learn as time goes on to kind of work off of his scoring gravity to create more open looks, become better in the pick and roll as a creator, and all of that shit. But my whole thing is like, if you go, I tweeted this earlier, if you look at Tyrese Maxey and Jamal Murray at their age 21 seasons, they're almost identical. And maybe Jamal Murray isn't like an all-NBA player, but I think that he's at least an all-star caliber player and at worst a sub-all-star player. So like, what I can take from this season is like, I've gotten in trouble with the stat comparisons before because like, you never know what can happen with the fucking Sixers. Like, obviously Tyrese Maxey could forget how to play basketball tomorrow and this would all be fucking pointless. But I think that he's shown, like, there was a stretch, like, we couldn't score in that Hawks game to start the game. Doc decided to bring him off the bench for some reason. And then the second that he was in, it was like an injection of offense. He closed the quarter brilliantly, was hitting step back threes. Like, you see enough flashes from him this season, and you see like the Heat game where like he's kind of taking over a little bit, that like it's undeniable in my mind that the I don't want to say the floor, but it feels like the median outcome for him as a sub all-star, the ceiling for him is like a borderline all NBA guy, and the floor for him is probably like Dennis Schroeder, or like someone that's like a good effective sixth man that can come off the bench and be really good. So like I feel really good about Tyrese Maxey, as I've said over and over.
Yeah, I think right now he's basically at that sort of Dennis Schroeder level already. And I remember they're talking last year, Spike Mike were talking on the rest of Ricky Sanchez about a potential kind of Kyle Lowry type future for him. And that seems not outside of the realm of possibility for me. He does seem, I mean, we'll see whether he ever has the kind of range that Kyle Lowry does. But he seems to have both the same sort of explosiveness and the toughness and the kind of intangibles that are already sort of coming along. And he's already answered a bunch of questions this season that I would not have expected him to answer in a second year. He's already had kind of that initial outburst of scoring prolificness when Joel was out, came back to earth, and now has kind of settled at a sort of happy medium without seeming to change his game too dramatically or get discouraged too dramatically. He's found ways to kind of play around Joel, and he has been that sort of, you know, he's been both the sort of spark plug off the bench or in second units for us, but he's also contributed down the stretch in games. Like he's basically done everything I would have wanted him to do this season. I still don't know if the timeline with this team is still kind of wonky. Like I don't know if he's going to be able to develop into that sort of secondary scorer that the Sixers need to revolve around Joel in time for when Joel is sort of still going to be in his prime. It does seem like they might not quite match up there. So I mean, the great thing about him looking this great is that between him and Simmons, and we have a bunch of tradable contracts, we have a bunch of picks, we have a bunch of other kind of flyer type good young players. Like if a major star that did fit our needs, and who even knows who that's going to be at this point, but if they did become available, we would be able to put together a package as good as anybody. But between those two guys and between all of our sort of manageable contracts other teams could probably offer more in the way of draft capital. Like, you know, if we got in a bidding war with the Thunder and what the team that was trading their guy was looking for was picks, then we'd lose that. But if it was one of these kind of like Spurs and Kawhi Leonard deals where they want a star to contribute now and they want a guy for down the line and then they're not really interested in a 5-year plan, then we have the guys for that between Simmons and Tyrese. And I know most Sixers fans now are already talking about Tyrese being off the table. I'm not there yet. Like, I love the guy. I it's a joy watching him play, certainly, and he gives the team something that nobody else does. But again, like, is he going to be the second best player on a championship contending Sixers team? Maybe, but not definitely, and I would probably bet against it. How are you on that sense?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you. I think that for anyone at his age, it's a lot to ask. I think that from what I've seen so far, I do believe that he is a future star. I think we could be talking potentially, like, with the way that he's developed from his first year to his second year, and with the three-point shot being the way it is, I feel like the last piece is really that playmaking piece. If he can become, and this is something that Zaire Wade, who's Dave from Twitter, who is one of the smarter Sixers fans that I follow, tweeted at me earlier. He's like, if you watch a lot of like young Donovan Mitchell, Maxey actually has better like assist numbers, and he actually has lower turnovers, and of course he has a lower usage rate than Donovan Mitchell. He's being asked to do a lot with the Jazz, but like one of the things that he's like, he's not some brilliant playmaker, passer, like whatever, but they have asked him to basically work off of his scoring gravity, off of the pull-up three-point shooting, off of the ability to get downhill and beat guys off the dribble. And they've essentially just been like, look, just make the right pass and everything else will figure itself out. Now, it took Donovan Mitchell, who was older when he came into the league, he was like 21 years old as a rookie, and he's 25 now, I believe. Like, it even took him, like, I don't even really think he was like an all-star level player until like last year in the playoffs, really. Mm-hmm. And like, I think he was a sub-all-star. I think he was very good, but like, he's 25 now. Like, unless Maxey makes this out of like, just like out of the world development track in the next year or two, he's probably not going to be that all-star level player that I think he can be until he's like 24 in 3 years. And by then, we're hoping that Joel Embiid is not in a wheelchair. Like, yeah. So I agree with you. I don't think that there's any situation where any player on this team other than Joel Embiid should be off the table. And even if they offered us Steph Curry, that is a situation where I would be like, yeah, well, you take Steph Curry. Like, like Joel himself said, like, if they offered Steph Curry and Klay Thompson for me, I would understand why they would trade me, kind of thing. So I agree with you. I think that if ultimately Maxey does become that two or three guy on a contender, that it's going to be some time from now, and that if you have to trade him, you trade him. But it's also like you're waiting for the right guy. Like, you're waiting for that All-NBA Hall of Fame level guy to become available, where you package him and Simmons or whatever you get back for Simmons and picks and contracts and whatever. I think that right now, like, there's like a list of guys that I would not trade. There's a list of guys I would trade Maxey for, and there's a list of guys that I would not. And the majority of those guys are that I am going to trade him for, like, in the top 20, in their prime now, and also a good fit with Joel Embiid. So, like, it's kind of hard to figure out, but ultimately I think that I think I would just hang on to Maxey until you know that, like, this is your moment, if that makes any sense. Like, this year is not our moment. No. Like, if it were next offseason and, like, Joel was, like, pressuring the front office and there was a star that was out there, and even if it was, like, a guy like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander or someone that's, like, maybe not top 20 right now but can be in the next year or two, then you would obviously have to do it. Like, I think that ultimately capitalizing on Joel Embiid's prime is the most important thing for this team, something that I've talked about over and over. But, like, if Maxey does stay a Sixer, I think there will be multiple All-Stars in his future.
Yeah, no, it's definitely possible. And I think he's definitely taken himself out of the running for those Kyle Lowry type trades. I mean, he probably did that months ago at this point. But yeah, I mean, when you compare it to someone like Donovan Mitchell or Jamal Murray, like, I think of that series 2 years ago when those guys were going head to head in the first round
in the bubble,
and
yeah,
routinely putting up like 45 point nights and just bombing from all over the place. I as fearless as Tyrese is as an attacker, he's not that fearless as a scorer. Now, maybe that'll come, but again, that seems several years down the line, if at all.
Do you think Doc kind of hamstrings him a little bit, though? Because I feel like he does. I feel like the thing that it's like, I think early in the season they were trying to make Maxey into Rajon Rondo, and now they've realized they just kind of got to let him cook a little bit more. And, like, as good as Maxey has been on, like, corner threes this year, and, like, once again, he's better on pull-up threes than he is on catch-and-shoots on the season, like, I feel like using Maxey in his current role, like, as a spacer, not letting him run bench units more and not giving him that confidence that, like, a primary ball handler could have, might actually hamstring his development as a scorer a little bit.
Yeah, and it's tough. I mean, it is tough with Doc playing these sort of all bench lineups. You do kind of want him to stagger the minutes a little more so that Maxey can run that second unit. But and it's also tough because right now the two man game is just more effective with Seth Curry in the guard spot than it is with Tyrese. So it is sort of tough to get that kind of long term development for Tyrese. But some of that is also on Tyrese. If Tyrese was a more willing shooter, if he was a more, you know, kind of diverse playmaker, then maybe they wouldn't need to run so much of those actions with Seth instead of him. They could kind of trust him to be the guy down the stretch running that two-man game with Joel. So, I do think it'll come. And certainly, again, we've seen everything that we could possibly ask to see from Tyrese this year. I mean, he's not going to make a jump from, you know, a first-year spot minute guy to a second-year All-Star. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But we've seen it's been as big of a jump as we could have asked him to possibly make, you know, reasonably. And so you don't want to rush him, but on this team, you will kind of have to rush him because we just don't know how long Joel has left at this level, and the fact that he's even still at this level at age, what, 28 is he now? 29? Something like that.
28, I think, yeah.
Yeah, you just can't ever take it for granted. And that's actually been that would sort of be the second biggest thing for me, maybe, is that not just Joel, but, you know, it feels weird saying this in a year where it feels like we played maybe three games without a third of the lineup out. Health has sort of been on our side this year, like, yeah, obviously not with COVID.
All things considered, though.
Yeah, and that'll kind of balance out for the entire league before the year is over. But Joel looks like Joel. Nobody else on the team, you know, aside from Ben, if you want to call that an injury, no one else on the team is really struggling with any kind of nagging or long term issues. You know, Tobias is dinged up. There's certain, you know, nips and tucks here and there, but for the most part, we have the full complement of guys, again, aside from Ben, and everyone is sort of playing at their own level. And look, I mean, like, in today's NBA, even beyond the COVID stuff, you really can't take that for granted. A year where everybody, all the key players on your team are healthy, and especially Joel, who, you know, he's played through kind of lingering injuries, and he's played through things where, you know, you never know if he was going to be in the lineup from one day to the next. This year, for the most part, unless he's got rest games or unless, you know, for the time he missed when he was positive, you know, he's going to be there. And yep. And that's a huge, huge thing for this team. And it's a huge thing just for our personal sanity. And that's definitely a thing to be grateful for.
Most importantly, in today's, we need sanity as much as possible with everything that's going on in the world. We need it. We need that from a basketball team, a group of men we'll never meet in our lives, and they have no idea who we are. Yet I sit here every week, and you write about them, and I talk about them, and you know all that shit. Actually, Joel follows me on Twitter, so he kind of knows me.
That's right. Congratulations about that.
Thank you, sir. It's a great accomplishment. I'll put it on the resume. But moving on to my next silver lining thing here, unless you have one to add.
No, go for it.
Okay. So Charles Bassey is good enough to be a backup center, but I don't think he's good enough that teams are going to steal him. So I think that, like, remember the contract fiasco we had preseason where it's like they want this guaranteed year and the team doesn't want to give it and blah, blah, blah. And then, like, so now he's like, I think he's locked up for the next 2 years, but like the next 2 years are non-guaranteed. Those are definitely going to get guaranteed. And I think that the fact that he just like does little positive things, like I feel like being a backup center, for all of the Sixers' struggles to not be able to figure out the backup center thing, it feels like one of the easier things to fill. Like every year I see some new guy I've never fucking heard of come out of nowhere and be like, oh, this, and like the NBA podcast world will like fall in love with like, yeah, Nicholas Claxton or like Daniel Gafford or like some
guy. Seven on the Heat. I can't remember what his first name is.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. There's always just some random guy who like pops off. And I feel like we finally have that with Bassey, where like he just makes positive plays on offense, does all the things you want a backup center to do, but he's not great enough that like teams are going to be like, we need that guy. So I think that they might have finally found the solution, like a young backup on a decent contract that will be able to stay with the team for a few years, because we can't keep doing this veteran minimums thing. And that's not even a knock on Andre Drummond. I actually think he's been pretty good overall. But it's just like, it's not a sustainable strategy to get guys on 1 year vet minimums every year. And I think Bassey can fill that spot.
Yeah, and I do like how between Bassey and Paul Reed, we sort of always have one guy worth crushing on, like as a fan base. Reed is sort of, I guess he's kind of fallen out of favor the last few weeks.
I know, but like, watch the G League stuff, man. Like, I know it sounds insane, but like, I'm like, he has skill. He has like, and a lot of it is him dominating because of his size in the G League, but like, he has moments where I'm like, I feel like we're going to trade this guy, and in 3 years, he's going to be like Christian Wood or some shit.
Yeah, I mean, if he was just a subpar shooter rather than like a humiliating shooter, yeah, I think he'd sort of already be there. But like,
yeah, absolutely.
You look at that guy's form from deep, and it's just like, okay, he's never going to be that guy. Or at least 7 years before we can trust him to be that guy. Bassey, you know, he does kind of fit the part a little bit more. He's a little bit more of a conventional, I guess, backup. And I was a big fan of Tony Bradley last year. I mean, yeah, I thought it was worth giving him up for George Hill, and ended up not being. But I thought that decision was defensible at the time. But yeah, Bassey is a good replacement for him. I don't think it's really going to make a difference for this team long term, especially once we get to the playoffs, because I just don't see Doc trusting him over Drummond unless Drummond is hurt or sick or not on the team anymore. And I don't see that necessarily happening by choice. But yeah, I mean, Bassey's definitely been a bright spot. I definitely enjoy watching him on the court. He does a lot of positive things, a lot of small things, and yeah,
screener, decent, okay passer, like gets in passing lanes on defense, blocks. Decent rim protector. Like, yeah, he's pretty good.
And he's got quick reflexes, which is a thing very, very much lacking on this team. Yes. Length and quick reflexes. So like that combination, he'll go a long way with this team if he can get consistent minutes. But again, it's not too likely to happen this season, I don't think. And I don't know. These guys, they never seem to stick around as long as we want them to. But you're right that he's not lighting the world on fire. He's probably not going to get poached anytime soon. So maybe if he's still here next year and we don't find the logical like end to the trilogy of I guess it would be JaVale McGee next. I think DeAndre Jordan maybe. Like, I guess it's one of those DeAndre two guys. Jordan,
but I can live with JaVale McGee. He's been good for the Suns this year.
He has been, yeah.
Also Sixers legend.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, we would be a good return process guy. He can follow up one of the greatest dunks in Sixers history.
That's right.
But yeah, feeling one of those guys, it would be nice to see him kind of develop in that role next year. But you just never know. The Sixers have never totally trusted one of these guys before, at least not since they've been good. So you'd hate to put all your chips on it happening this time.
Yeah, I think that you can't get too excited, but I also think that like we just need a guy to fill in for when Embiid's injured, and we need a guy that we know we can have consistency from. And I think that Bassey brings that in terms of like actually being on the team and also just like being young and having maybe a little bit more upside to be like maybe even better than a backup center. We hope that he doesn't, you know, take the Rashawn Holmes route where he's so good that it's like he's going to get a bag in a few years. But but for now, it's looking pretty good. And I think that if you were another team and you were looking for, you know, if there's any sort of star package out there, there's plenty of young guys you could pick from on the Sixers that you at least can see the potential in to be like a good rotation player in the NBA if you're trying to like start a rebuild. So there's that. I have more. Would you like to do one or do you want me to do one? I know we're running over a little bit on time.
No, yeah. I had one more, but I guess for me, like the last big one I can even really the only one I can even really think of is just that 8-2 start in general. Like that, like I remember we were watching the Nets. I think they played the Nets in the preseason.
Yeah,
and it was like a rout. Isaiah Joe had one of his incredible games, and it was like, you know, they won comfortably by 30 with the Nets playing most of their guys and a bunch of key Sixers out.
Yes, I'll never.
And I was like, okay, this is more joy than I expect to get from this entire regular season coming up. And I was like, if we get even like one game like this in the regular season, I'll be happy. And we got a bunch of them. Like we that 8-2 start with the two wins against the Bulls, and that was such a higher high than I expected this team to get to at any point.
Yeah, and the Bulls were good, and they were healthy.
Yeah, no, and they were legitimate wins. Some of them were on the road. I was not expecting the entire sort of road home split for the Sixers to kind of reverse polarity this year, but at the time that felt meaningful. And yeah, like just that entire stretch of just watching really competent, really coherent basketball was really quite gratifying. And again, like I never expected it to be that good at any point in this season. So the fact that we had it and then lost it still seems better than not having it at all.
Wow. That was poetic. I like that. yeah, no, I agree. And then of course Joel gets COVID and everything goes downhill from there. But, yeah, no, I agree. I mean, and also just winning against the Bulls, those games, like, I don't think the Sixers are going to beat pretty much any of the top five teams in the East in a playoff series this year if they don't resolve the Ben Simmons situation. But I will say I'd feel most confident against the Bulls than I would against the Heat or against the Nets or the Bucks or one of those top teams. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like the Bulls, like, I think Joel's just kind of a matchup nightmare for them. And then Furkan shoots like Steph Curry against them. So Steph Turkey, maybe for a series, you never know. But we'll see if we ever even get to that point. We might not even make it out of a plan at this point. So as I say on the Silver Linings, let me just run through my last few here. I like that one because it is a good positive note that we've already seen this season. But my last three here I have are higher draft pick potentially. I think right now
you can never rule that out. Yeah, you can never take that for granted with this team, certainly.
I mean, right now I think we have like the 18th or 19th pick, and like the last time we had the 21st pick, we got Tyrese Maxey.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we'll see with Jaden Springer, but like he's still very young. Like, I know they traded away Mikal Bridges, but technically they drafted Mikal Bridges. Like
the Matisse, they've had very good luck in the late first round the last half decade or so.
Shamit, Shake Milton, Bassey, like Reed and Joe have shown flashes and like you see the potential with them, but like the reality is they're not NBA rotation players right now. And you would hope that they would get there eventually, but like I like the process of pretty much all of their picks except for maybe the Petrzev pick, because I don't know if we'll ever see him on an NBA court. But overall, I feel pretty good about the Sixers scouting team. And if they get the 17th pick and AJ Griffin slides down the board like he is right now for some reason, which makes no sense to me and it probably won't happen, but like I would like to just get another steal that we can get in the draft, and that would make me feel good. Or we could attach it to whoever and get back a star player. So positive note there. Shake Milton is an NBA player again. That was the concern going into the season for me. I felt like Shake was a disaster at the end of last season outside of the Hawks game where he shots the fucking lights out. And I just feel like Shake is like a solid bench guard, and like we needed that. We really needed that win out of Shake this year.
Yeah, and it's still weird to me that the one thing we thought we could definitely rely on Shake for, I mean, maybe not weird because he's a Sixer, but
of course,
you know, going into last season, it's like, all right, we don't know if this guy's ever going to be a kind of top level scorer or top level defender or whatever, but he can shoot. We know he can shoot. He can definitely shoot. Famous, and of course, now he can do everything else, but he's a, you know, a low 30s 3-point shooter. It doesn't look like he's going to snap out of that anytime soon.
If we ever get back, though.
Yeah, well, who knows? You can never write it out entirely. But the main thing with Shake for me, like the thing that just drove me nuts last year, was that he always seemed to be fuming. He was fuming at the refs. He was fuming at Doc and his teammates. Calls he wasn't getting, shots that weren't falling. I felt like frying an egg on his forehead most games. And this year, he seems chill. That's all I ever wanted from Shake Milton. I just chill, Shake. Be a nice chill Shake for us.
Yeah, maybe he went to South America, did some ayahuasca or something. He's been maybe his third eye's opening up a little bit.
Yeah, hope he does it again next offseason.
And then my last thing I have here is I just think it's good that there is a little bit of pressure on this team. Because I think that, not that the Sixers haven't had pressure in the past, but like I think it's good there's pressure on Doc Rivers to win. And I think it's good that there's pressure on Daryl Morey to make the right Ben Simmons trade. And I think that it's good that both of them might not be seen as like bulletproof in their jobs. Because I think that pressure is ultimately what leads to people. I don't think Doc will ever take more risk. That's just not who he is. He is conservative Lincoln Project man who will never take risks and be, you know, the coach that he is. But it is good to light a fire under him a little bit, just in generally speaking. And with Daryl Morey, I feel like he's probably felt he's in the second year of his job and he feels very comfortable. And if the team is to go off the rails, his last real chance, this is something that Bodner brought up, is like if you look at the history of like what it takes for a coach to get fired, is the GM being under pressure, basically. Mm-hmm. But like, if Morey fucks up this situation so bad with the Simmons thing that the ownership starts to be like, all right, what the fuck did we sign up for here? Then it could lead to either a potential Doc firing or some turmoil in the organization that could lead to positive things overall. That could lead to taking more risks and making all-in moves for maybe next season or the following season or whatever it is, so that we can really take that leap from being like a fake contender to a real contender. So that's kind of my spiel on that.
Yeah, and I guess you need that eventually. I'm a little worried because I don't want us to trade, you know, Chris Paul for Russell Westbrook. But
true.
And I don't know, the Doc thing. Like because this has basically been a write off season for me, I don't get too hung up on the fire Doc Rivers part of it. Like I agree that he's probably not going to be the guy who gets us to the other side of the mountain, but. And, you know, he can do this well for the most part. I mean, game to game, there's going to be things that frustrate you, but he can kind of keep a team together for a season, or at least he has in the past and he did last year. So that to me is not like action item number one is to replace Doc Rivers. I know it's starting to be that way for a lot of fans, and I don't blame him because he is very frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, it's like you're only as good as your players. Like, I really do think that, like, yes, there are coaches that give you advantages in the NBA, and there are things that, like you said, like from game to game, Doc makes me want to pull my fucking hair out when he does stupid shit a lot. But at the same time, if, like, Giannis Antetokounmpo plays, like, the best player in the world for a stretch of games last year and the Bucks win the finals, and everyone doesn't think Coach Bud is an idiot anymore. So, there you go.
Yeah, so it's a lot of that, certainly. It does seem like Daryl's going to need a push at some point, especially if that perfect trade doesn't necessarily present itself. But I don't know. Daryl has this kind of quiet arrogance to him that makes me think that he's really – I think he would almost rather be fired than make a trade that he's not comfortable with. Yeah. So I don't know if that pressure is going to end up amounting to much, but it might make one of those kind of 50-50 trades where it's like, well, this could be the move or this could not be the move. Maybe it's the move because he is going to Heat.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, the Tillman Fertitta thing where it's like Tillman and Harden were like, trade Chris Paul for Russell Westbrook, and he didn't want to do it. And yeah, he didn't get fired, but he left right after the season when it didn't go well. So yeah, you never know. I mean, I know Mike has said on Rice Ricky Sanchez, he feels like there's just going to be one day where Doc's just like, yeah, I'm leaving, I'm gone. Like, you know what I mean? But then again, like you look at his contract and you're like, that guy wants to get fucking paid. I don't fucking blame him. He's getting paid a lot of money. He's going to hang on. And then eventually it might get to the point where like one of the two leave. But I do think that pressure can create can create that risk-taking thing that I think that Morey has been kind of risk-averse since he's gotten here. He's made good, not great moves, and I think lighting a fire under him could be great. So, all right, well, that's a good place to wrap it. Thank you so much. I know we went over the expected time, but I really appreciate you coming on, AU. It was a great time talking to you, and I hope that I can have you on again in the future.
Yeah, man, love to do it. Thanks for having me. It's been a good time talking about reasons to be positive. You know, we don't get a lot of chances to talk about that, especially as people who know each other mostly on Twitter. So, good stuff.
That's true. It's a hell site. All right, peace.
All right, see ya.